So here we go, the same equation, Maxwell's equations. Now I'm going back to some of my notes, and we'll quickly go through lecture number one notes, and then we'll continue lecture number two notes. These are the equations that we're going to focus on, learn what they mean, try to understand their implications. Going a little bit earlier, here I have Lorentz force that I have mentioned last time. Force equals charge times E plus B cross B. One should consider this equation, and one should consider another very modern thought that Einstein sort of like taught to us. In all reference systems, the form of physical laws are the same. So if in some reference system this is a reality, okay, the same reality also applies in other reference systems, not only in this room, but also in the bus that is passing by the street. The same law applies there too. Therefore, we write that law in terms of some prime quantities. Okay, F prime equals Q times B prime plus B prime cross B prime. Okay? And perhaps F and F prime are the same. Okay? And in Newtonian mechanics, F and F prime are the same. Alright, so that leads to certain conclusions. Okay, so we can consider the B to be the velocity of a charge in the lab, and E and B might refer to the electric and magnetic fields in the lab frame. Okay, but then there's another frame, which is the frame of this charge. And in the frame of this charge, the charge has what type of a velocity? Velocity is equal to? I see a charge here moving 1 meter per second. If I go into that same frame, what is the charge velocity?
Zero.
So that if that is the case, V prime corresponding to the charge velocity in charge on frame is equal to zero. Then we have Q times E prime equals F prime. Okay? Newtonianly speaking, F and F prime are the same. Therefore, that brings us into this equation. Basically, we cross out this guy, because V prime is equal to zero, the velocity of the charge in its own frame. Therefore, E prime is equal to E plus V cross B. What we are seeing is that somehow the combination of the electric field and the magnetic field that are measured in the lab combine together to become the electric field in the frame of reference of the charge. So this shows that E's and B's are sort of like very intrinsically related. They are combined in various ways to morph into E's and B's further. Okay? And of course, we already know that E's are due to charges, and B's are due to the motion of charges. So we expect that there is a set of relationship that relates E's and B's in every reference frame to the charges that stay there and move there and also carry currents there. So there has to be some relationships. And these relationships are indeed these equations, Maxwell's equations. Okay? These are not derived equations. These are compiled equations. A whole bunch of scientists at the beginning of the 19th century started doing experiments. These are known names. Gauss was a mathematician and a physicist doing experiments. There was Oersted, there was Ampere, there was Faraday. All these guys went into the lab, made measurements related to electricity and magnetism. At some point, they understood that these originally distinct what was thought to be distinct phenomena, electricity and magnetism, are related to one another. Okay, and eventually, Maxwell, when he compiled all these into mathematical equations and added his own insight, united not only magnetism with electricity, also he united both of these things, that is electromagnetism, with light. Everything fell together from these equations. Okay, so these equations should be viewed as historically compiled set of equations. You go into the lab, make some experiments. The experiments suggest to you that you should define concepts of electric field and magnetic field and try understanding how they relate to the amount of charge there is, amount of charge there is in motion that is current, and all those relationships coming from various scientists compiling at the desk of Professor Maxwell, who was somewhere there in England in Cambridge, mathematically very able. He had the right mathematical background, which Faraday, a superb experimenter, lacked, okay? And he put those together, all those ideas, into this set of equations. Any questions about this idea? He had one important contribution. This last equation is Ampere's law, and Ampere, this French scientist, suggested effectively what may be del cross B is equal to mu naught times J, all right? And that's what his experiments were suggesting. And then this would be the Maxwell's equation. Maxwell looked at these equations, hey, there is something wrong here, okay? He identified that this equation by itself would violate charge conservation. That was one thing that was wrong. The other thing that was wrong is that there is an asymmetry in this equation. This equation says that electric fields are somehow being produced in consequence of time-changing magnetic fields. He says, well, he had this idea, this right notion, maybe intuition, that maybe things should be complementary. There should be also a generation of magnetic fields due to changing electric fields. And he had to write something down like this. That was a theoretical step. That didn't come because of an experimental observation. But right math, right intuition, going on a limb, and making a prediction, a conjecture that can be furthermore tested in the lab. And that test came when Heinrich Hertz, a few years later, after Maxwell wrote these equations, did the right experimental confirmation. And that experimental confirmation was nothing other than having time-varying currents producing electromagnetic waves, which are then detected at some other point. Because as soon as Maxwell introduced this last term, which is called the displacement current term, then the equations combined together to produce a wave equation that was on my backside of my t-shirt last time. Okay? And that wave equation predicts the propagation of electromagnetic waves with a speed which has been experimentally determined, which is what we call C, which has a value of more or less 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second in the MKS system. Okay? So all of a sudden, these equations not only combine electricity and magnetism, but also say that electricity and magnetism, or electromagnetism, has something to do with light. Light is one of the phenomena that is associated with this sort of thing. Okay? So coming back to these equations and following and finishing our review, E is the electric field measured in volts per meter. B is the magnetic field in MKS system that we use. It is Webers per meter square or Teslas. This is the right unit. All right? And rho is charge density, coulombs per meter cube. J is the current density. It's a vector. While rho is a scalar, J is a vector. And its magnitude is measured in units of amperes per meter square. And then there are these two constants there, epsilon naught and mu naught. And you know from your physics courses that these are the permittivities and permeabilities of free space, correct? Say correct. All right, thank you. I want to interact, right? I mean, I can't just lecture all the time. And in the MKS system that we use in engineering applications, those constants turn out to be in Henry's per meter, 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 for the permeability of free space, and for permittivity, well, it's the inverse of more or less 36 pi times 10 to the 9, okay? And then when you combine them as 1 over the square root of their product, you get the speed of light, which is more or less 3 times 10 to the 8, okay? So this is not exact, but it is more or less the same as C is more or less 3 times 10 to the 8. Okay, for your own, as you do homework and as you give answers in the exams, basically adopt this approximation for epsilon naught. 1 over 36 pi times 10 to the 9, because then maybe some pi's will cancel, etc. You will get nicer results rather than using the exact value. Just like we don't want you to use the exact value of C, which I don't remember what it is. Okay, but it's so close to the 3 times 10 to the 8, this is good enough. Any questions here? All right, so then, when you combine these two equations, if you substitute into this equation, you get this wave equation. And when you solve that wave equations, you get wave solutions of Maxwell's equations, of which the simplest types are as follows. They are cosinusoidal functions of time and space, okay? 2 pi f f is some frequency, t minus z over c. Z over c is a delay factor. So these are traveling waves, and associated with each frequency, of course, frequency is the inverse of a period. These cosinusoidal functions go up and down, and in some time t, they produce one cycle. Inverse of t is what we refer to as f. Okay? But if you were plot to same function as a function of position, you would get now in space a wavelength. Okay? And that wavelength and the frequency are such that f times lambda is equal to c. This is an important relationship. Okay? And the propagation velocity of this cosinusoid is something like this at a snapshot at some time t. At a later time, you will see that it has moved in by some amount, and that velocity is c, that is the speed of light, 3 times 10 to the 8, which is the c that is showing up here. So if the signal moves some distance z with the speed c, then this happens over a delay, z over c, and that is the delay that we are seeing over here. Okay. So, also it turns out that, as I already mentioned last time, Maxwell's equations are linear. Because they are linear, all the solutions can be superposed, and they still are solutions. So if you have cosinusoidal solutions with different frequencies, you take a bunch of them, you add them up, you create new solutions that no longer look cosinusoidal. Okay, this was the gist of Fourier analysis and Fourier synthesis we learned in ECE 210. Okay, so taking enough cosinusoids, which are all propagating with the same velocity c, you generate shapes that are propagating in space that may look like even step functions, more or less. They are also propagating at the velocity c. Okay, if such a perturbation caused by some source goes across some distance l, and it is due to that with a transit time or a delay time l divided by c. So that turns out to be an important number to take into account. Any questions here? If not, let's go to the statics equation from the dynamic equations. These are the dynamic equations, but if I kill all the ddt terms, the terms that are depending on time, therefore giving us time derivative. If we are in a static situation, all those time derivatives are going to be equal to zero, and these equations are going to simplify. They simplify into these two sets. Now we have an electrostatics equations and magnetostatics equations. There is no more coupling. The coupling between E fields and B fields are coming from the time variations of these fields. Okay? So we can attack simple problems. We can just take these two equations and solve these equations and have electrostatic solutions. These are the electric fields that are being produced by static distributions of charges. That's it. Okay? Now, in real life, it's very hard to have all these charges sitting statically because life is dynamic. Okay? So it's a mathematical idealization of some sort. But it's a useful one. Even if it cannot be realized, let's learn how to solve those problems, because then if the charges are moving sufficiently slow, we can extend those solutions in the quasi-static sense that I mentioned last time. Likewise, we have magnetostatic equations, another set. Okay? And these two sets are sort of asymmetric in the sense that for the electrostatics, the electric field has zero curl. Electrostatic fields are curl-free, whereas magnetic fields are zero divergence. And that has something to do with what I was saying at the end of last lecture. They have zero divergence because there are no magnetic charges. It is the existence of electrical charges that gives a divergence to the electric field. And then we have all these electric field vectors lining up to have field lines that start on positive charges and end up on negative charges, like some of those animations that we have looked at. That's true in electrostatic. In magnetostatics, there are no charges for magnetic field to start on and to end up with. That's why divergence of B is equal to zero. But rather, it has a curl. That curl depends on J. So static magnetic fields are curly, while the static electric fields are pointy. They are sort of like radially moving out, starting from charges, ending up on other charges. Okay, so these important sort of like observations translate into the corresponding math. We're going to have a scalar potential that can solve the electrostatic equations, and we will have a vector potential that can solve this sort of problem. Any questions here? So we will spend the first 10 lectures of this course, more or less, concentrating on the static equations, because they will provide us with the background to do the dynamics later on. Okay? Quasi-statically, we adopt them Snapshot by snapshot, we say they are quasi-statically valid if the sources are changing, sources being rows and j's changing very slowly, but when they are changing faster, we will still have a recipe eventually. The details of this you will through the learning 350. There is still a recipe taking the static equation solutions and turn them into fully dynamic solutions. And that is the replacement of time with delay times. Okay, that is the gist of radiation theory that is covered at the beginning of ECE 350. Any questions here? Okay, so then this quasi-static idea is okay as long as time delays across the size of the system that you are concerned with in modeling. That time delay is negligible. If the time delay is negligible, and that means that the time delay L over C should be small compared to the period associated with the source that is relevant in the system. You may have a circuit. In that circuit, you'll have a time-varying voltage source, and that voltage source will have the highest frequency that is corresponding to a period. Okay, that is the fastest changes that are taking place due to that source. Okay, if the delay at the speed of light across the system, L over C is small compared to this period, then you're good. Then you can use the static solutions. Okay, that very calculation, T is, period is large compared to the delay time, flip it around and make it L is less than C over T, and then remember that T, the period, is the inverse of frequency. Okay, C over F, but what is C over F according to this equation, lambda, okay? So if the system size is much less than lambda, you're good with the static approximation. Simply take the static solution and make it now change in time, just like the source is changing time, without worrying about any delay factors. That is the solution of Maxwell's equation, the approximate solution of Maxwell's equation, which has been captured in the circuit theory that you have learned in ECE 110 and 210, okay? Conversely, if that is not the case, if the size of the system is larger than a wavelength, then you have to do more stuff, which is you take 329 and stick with it until the end and learn the transmission line theory. Okay? So what does this say? This equation says that as long as you have small circuits, maybe ECE 210 is correct. But that's not really true. What if you have a small circuit, physically small, but you are working at real high frequencies, so that equation is no longer correct, okay? At real high frequencies, the wavelength is going to be very small. Because the wavelength is very small, even though L is small, you may be violating this thing. And that happens with our computers, for instance, or our communication system. We want to always use higher and higher frequencies. Why do we want higher and higher frequencies? Bandwidth. We wanna do things fast, we wanna pass a lot of information, and that forces us to consider and build systems that operate at high frequencies. Even though physically they may be small, because we are operating at high frequencies, these time delays are important, and that's why 210 is not sufficient. That is why you are required to pay 329. Anyways, that's the discussion that I have here, fields and circuits. I'm not going to go through that anymore. There is a link there to a paper by some professor from Northwestern. Please load that, download that, and read that. That's a very nice discussion of why electrical engineers of any flavor, including computer engineers, need to know all this stuff. Okay, it's not just for general culture, which is good enough of a reason, but for practical reason, you need to know this stuff. Okay, any questions? So the rest of yesterday's lecture that I didn't show, but you know, I talked all about this. We are three-dimensional space. We often refer it in terms of Cartesian coordinates, and we envision at every location in that space to exist an electric field and magnetic field that depend on both position and time, and these are vector quantities, which in Cartesian coordinates means that they have scalar components in x, y, and z directions. And r is our little position vector, and these combine into Lorentz force to describe the force that is applied by the fields on a charge. That goes into Newton equation to predict the dynamics of that charge, but the fields themselves are governed by Maxwell's equations, which of course hold in this frame of reference, as well as in the frame of reference of the bus that is moving, as well as the reference frame of a spaceship that is moving around. All these are the same equations. That was Einstein's insistence. All laws of physics have identical forms in all reference frames, and that eventually showed a contradiction with the Newtonian dynamics, which then led to the relativity idea coming in and replacing Newtonian dynamics. All these changes are only important if you are moving very fast. Therefore, Newtonian dynamics is still a good approximation in everyday situations. And basically, we can say that because Maxwell's equations were put together somehow exactly correctly, taking relativistic details into account prior to understanding relativity, it eventually inspired Einstein to see what relativity is, okay? So one of the revolutions of physics in the 20th century, relativity, left Maxwell's equation unharmed. In fact, it came from Maxwell's equations. The weird fact that speed of light is the same in all reference frames is exactly what precipitated this. And that's exactly what Maxwell's equations applied identically in every reference system predicts for you. It always gives you propagation velocity c, whatever reference frame. That was very odd, and it contradicted our common sense, but sometimes common sense can be misled because our common sense is exercised and developed in usual situations where we are not moving so fast compared to the speed of light. Anyways, so the other big revolution was the quantum revolution. And again, its emergence has something to do with radiation solutions of Maxwell's equations. And even that revolution left our electromagnetic wave equations, the field equations, unharmed. Okay, so what we are learning here, which is one of the sort of like the main conclusions of the classical physics, turns out to be also completely valid in the modern physics that we are now exercising in the 21st century, including nanotechnology and so forth. So that's an amazing sort of a thing. These equations describe everything that we know about electricity and magnetism and light. Okay, so that's all I have to say, except that look at this example. This example is something that is very similar to one of the homework problems that you'll be solving due Friday. In this example, we give the velocity and force applied to a charge in a given situation, but with three different velocities, giving rise to three different forces, and then using Lorentz force, you are able to deduce the field, electric field and the magnetic field in that frame of reference, okay? So there's a homework problem just like this. If you are confused at the outset what to do with that problem, just look at this and that will help you with this, solving that problem. Okay. Let's go. This is the homework. Let's go to lecture number two. Okay? So now, what did we say? Maxwell's equations simplify under static situations, and the law that's applicable to electrostatics, the divergence of E is equal to rho over epsilon naught. This is actually Gauss's law in the differential form. This is the same equation as the flux integral surface integral in E dot ds is equal to the charge enclosed divided by epsilon. It's the same equation. And curl of E is equal to zero. We will find out that this is the same as taking a loop integral of the electric field around any closed loop and saying that is equal to zero. Okay, those relationships will show up over the next several lectures when we go back in more detail to what you learned in 212 and what you learned in 241. Okay? But these are the equations that apply when charges are distributed in such a way that they are not changing their positions. Stationary charges generate electric fields that obey these two rules jointly. How does that come about? Well, that comes about because a single charge produces an electric field that is given by this equation that we call Coulomb's electric field. Okay, and how does that come about? It comes about as follows. If you have two distinct charges separated by some distance r, they're going to either pull or push one another in a manner that is very reminiscent of the gravitational force, okay? There is going to be a force that each of them experience that is proportional to the charge of one times the charge of the other and divided by the distance squared, okay? Whether there is pull or push depends on the charges, okay? In gravitation, we talk about masses, but all masses are positive. You know, we have a positive mass for the Earth, there is positive mass for me, and therefore there is an attraction, all right? In Coulomb's law, there can be attraction and there can be repulsion. And the rule is that like charges push rather than attract, they repel. Unlike charges attract one another, all right? So there's going to be some sort of an equation that says Q1, Q2 divided by some constant time R squared is the force. We take that force equation and delete one of the Q's. Then we go to an electric field equation, because electric field is force per unit charge. So specifically for this picture, okay, we imagine that a charge Q, big Q, at the origin is going to be pushing another charge, little q, at some distance r, with a force that is given as the product of little q multiplying this electric field that is indicated here. That electric field is the source charge divided by some constant times r squared. That constant is 4 pi times epsilon naught, the same epsilon naught that we talked about. Any questions here? This is a very simple idea. So basically, let us take as a property of charges that in their rest frames, they all produce these radially going out Coulomb fields. Every charge walks around with its Coulomb field. In its reference frame, this is what you see. Okay? Yes?
Is this just for a stationary?
This is just for, let's say that this is true in the reference frame of every charge. Whether a charge is stationary or not depends on which reference frame you are looking from, right? If you are in the same reference frame with the charge, then, of course, this is it, and it is stationary. But same charge can be passing you by, and then you don't exactly apply this equation. Okay? You apply it only static situations, but for the next 10 lectures or so, we will only be dealing with static situations, so let's keep that in mind. Okay? There are a few points where I will make an exception to that, just to make a link, to make a point, and I'll indicate it at that point. Okay? So this is a static solution. Yes. And from these static solutions, we can get those static solutions. That's my whole point in this lecture. Okay? It turns out that this law, Coulomb's law, that gives you the electric field of a point charge, plus the idea that the electric fields are superpositions of all point charge electric fields, leads you to the two equations that you see over there, which are two of Maxwell's four equations in the static limit. Any questions here? Okay? So it's a radially pointing out vector. Therefore, if little q is positive, it will be pushed. But if little q is negative, because of the negative sign, it will be pulled. So a proton will attract an electron, but two protons will repel one another. That's all built into this equation. What if we have several charges? If we have several charges, we have to do superposition. Okay? That superposition field is still useful in the following sense. If you know the field right here, because of the presence of three charges, if you calculate the vector field here, multiplied with the Q of a test charge that you bring here, and that will be a vector that is the right force that is applied by the three charges on that particular test charge. All right? So the location of that test charge may be this location little r that I show here. I wish I had a pointer, but I don't. This r shows the position of little q, which is a test charge. Okay, but we have another q, q sub n. Now we are in a situation where there are many distinct charges, each of them applying some field. Okay, and the Coulomb field due to that is going to be the source charge divided by the same constant 4 pi epsilon naught times the square of the distance from that charge to the location. And in terms of the vector, that is just r minus r sub n vector magnitude square that you can see through vector addition. Vector addition is very easy to see geometrically. You put vectors with arrowheads into tails, and then that indicates the summation. Okay, clearly r sub n plus r sub n minus r sub n, r minus r sub n, when you add them gives you r, so this is the correct indication here. Times a unit vector. And unit vectors are always obtained by taking vectors and dividing it by their magnitude. So that's a general formula. It is this general formula that was underlying the JavaScript pictures, animations that I showed last lecture. Here's an example. Now I take two charges, Q1 and Q2, and they are located at different locations. What does it say? Q1 is 4 pi epsilon naught. it's a positive charge, so it can cancel out that 4 pi epsilon on the bottom. Q2 is negative 2 Q1, okay, and then I sum vectorially to obtain a certain expression that I can code into my JavaScript. That's what I did. Vectorially speaking, when I make a plot of that, you see what happens. Can you see the two charge source locations from the geometry? Here is a positive charge and there is a negative charge, and the fields are, this is weaker, the other is smaller, and that's the way things are happening in this case. This is actually then the superposition, because the charges are unbalanced, of a single charge plus a dipole. When you have a plus and minus charges of the same amount separated by a certain distance, you call them a dipole. This is a dipole plus another charge. Okay. And if you were to now take the same picture and plot it at a different scale, so that now the periphery of your plot is quite distant away from the charges as compared to their original separation. Their original separation was 1 meter in x direction, 1 meter in y direction, so square root of 2 was the exact separation of the two charges in meters. But if you go at much larger scales, far away, you see a field structure that just looks like as if it's the field of a single charge. Okay, and because the negative charge was twice the size of the positive charge, we all read that that region close to the center of the our coordinate system is overall has a negative charge, and all the fields are going inward. So it all makes sense. These are stuff that you've done, and there are a few homework problems that are similar to this. It should be no problem. Now we step away from this idea towards the Gauss's law. Okay, I want to show you that we can derive this entire set of equations, the two equations that govern electrostatics, Coulomb's law. Coulomb's law plus superposition gives us electrostatic. And it is amazing, today we know something else. And this is not how it was historically done. Coulomb's law plus relativity derives you the entire set of Maxwell's equations. Although relativity was not known, in real life it went the other way around. Okay? Maxwell's equations were put together because of experimental observations, and then relativity was deduced. Okay, so how do we go from Coulomb's law into Gauss's law? It's just like these little pictures will do the job. The magnitude of the Coulomb field is E sub r, which is Q over 4 pi epsilon naught r square. Okay, I can rearrange that. I notice that 4 pi r square is the surface area at a distance r away from the charge. So why don't I rearrange that equation as follows. I take 4 pi r squared and put it on the other side. Epsilon is also carried to the other side. So now I epsilon naught the radial field, which is the same in all directions, it's isotropic for this Coulomb, times the surface area at a distance r is equal to q. Okay, so that's a scalar equality. And I say, hey, I suspect that maybe this scalar equality is really the evaluation of a sort of a something that comes from Math 241. Some sort of a surface integral is maybe what is going on underlying this. And I say, hey, this is it. If I take an electric field that is radially pointing out in all directions with the equal strength in all directions, and dot multiply it with an area increment ds, and take a closed surface integral, that closed surface integral will evaluate exactly to the E sub r at the surface, the value of the electric field, which is the same in all directions, but it depends with r, but at the surface it has a certain value, okay, that E sub r, times the surface area at that distance, which is 4 pi r squared. Evidently that product is going to give me, after epsilon naught, the charge in enclosed. Okay, so then I say Coulomb's law is telling me that this is also true, at least for the picture that is shown at the top. Okay, at least as far as this picture is concerned, Coulomb's law and this other Gauss's law-like equality that we obtain, they are equally valid. Okay, the next step is to do some mental exercises and see whether the same equation will hold true in other situations, okay? And one way of doing that might be to distort our surface from the original spherical surface into this weird surface and ask ourselves, is this going to give us the same thing or not? And after scratching your head a little bit, you're going to decide that this should evaluate to the same thing, for the very reason that I have a smaller surface area on this half than this half, but also the field is going to be different at that closer location, because I know the field is going as 1 over r squared, okay? So it's actually the field is going to be bigger because of r squared on the bottom, and I have a smaller r to contend with. So I have a larger field, smaller surface area, but they balance one another just exactly right, so that the contribution from the bottom is the same as the contribution from the top. So I say, hey, this is good. I can make this distortion. But now I can keep distorting like this all the other portions of the surfaces and still then come up with the equality, eventually come up with something like this, okay? I don't care what the shape of my surface is. I don't care whether the charge is at the center of this or smeared out in some other fashion. It doesn't matter, okay? This relationship holds true.
What relationship?
This relationship holds true, independent of the surface shape that I'm contending with, I'm working with. Whatever surface I have will be enclosed in some volume, and within that volume, there is going to be some amount of charge, okay? As long as I put the amount of charge contained within the volume as the right-hand side, the left-hand side is always going to be true, and it is always consistent with Coulomb's law and superposition. So that is the way you step out from Coulomb's law into something more general, that is Gauss's law. Any questions? Now, somebody asked, is Coulomb's law valid only for static situations or for moving charges? I gave the answer. It's not true for moving charges. If a charge is moving in my frame of reference, Coulomb's law doesn't produce the field that is produced by that moving charge. Okay? So that's what I said. However, amazing thing. It works out that once we step from Coulomb's law into Gauss's law, this relationship also applies for moving charges. Okay? That is something that has been experimentally confirmed. It's not at all obvious from the beginning, but that's the way things work out. So imagine a volume, this beach ball, all right? I'm making a beach ball here. Within the beach ball, there are, let's say, three distinct charges. They are stationary, okay? When you sum up the electric field over the beach ball surface, you get the total sum of those three charges, that is RQ, okay? The second situation, within that beach ball, those three charges are buzzing around like bees, okay? As long as they are not crossing the surface of that beach ball, I still have a total flux that is, by definition, this integral. At every instant, I take the instantaneous electric fields and add up. It still gives the same Q. So in that sense, we have the universality of Gauss's law written in this form, derived from, in some sense, from the Coulomb's law under static assumption, but it is generally true for time-varying situations as well. Any questions here? Now, you may say, what the hell is this surface integral? What is this surface integral? Well, then I'm going to say, hey, go and review your 241 notes. Okay, but maybe I can be a little bit more helpful. The surface integral, I imagine it as follows. Let's go back to the simplest picture here. We have a surface here. I imagine that surface to be composed of many, many, many little square patches, okay? If I make those square patches smaller and smaller while I'm increasing the number of those patches, I will approach that spherical surface in an elegant way, in a continuous way. Okay? Let's select in our mind a whole bunch of a large number of small squares, and on each of these squares, dot multiply the electric field vector that is measured at the center of that little patch, times another vector, and this vector is the area vector. That is our ds vector, okay? Every little patch has a certain area, and every little patch has an outward normal unit vector, okay? Multiply those two. Area times the unit vector, that is what I call delta s. That little vector, delta s, dot multiplied into the electric field at the center of that patch is one of those things that I'm going to sum up, with all the rest of the same guys coming from all the other patches that closes up this surface. Is that making sense?
Yep.
That sum is some number, okay? That sum, hopefully, if I have selected my little patches small enough, is not going to change all that much as I, in the limit, make those patches grow smaller while their numbers are increasing. I will be converging some quantity. That is the surface integral, okay? That is what, more or less, you have been shown in MAT 241, and that's the way to think about the flux integrals, surface integrals. Any questions? Now, although it's an integral, we hardly ever do calculus in calculating these things, simply because we apply these equations usually in symmetrical situations where we can sort of replace the calculus by multiplications, okay? Here, certainly, that entire operation is going to amount to multiplying the radial electric field, because it is symmetric, it's the same at every point with the total surface area. That's how you do it, okay? Well, in this equation, you have to do a little bit more work, but here the electric field is multiplied instead of the whole surface area of a sphere by half of it, but then you add to it another such second contribution coming from the bottom, and you get the same result, okay? So we apply these equations that are written in integral form in many situations where symmetry helps us to reduce those equations into easy calculational problems, okay? In other situations where that may be difficult to do, we sometimes resort to other forms, okay? Because this very equation that we have, Gauss's law, this equation is the same as divergence of E is equal to rho divided by epsilon naught, as we will see further down the line. So that is another way of dealing with the same equation. In some situations, we'll choose to use the differential form. In other situations, we'll choose to use this integral form. Any questions here? All right. We will evolve these equations slightly more. Let's say the product of epsilon naught times E is a new vector quantity that we call displacement. At this point, this is just a convenient shorthand, okay? But this has other units than electric field because epsilon naught has units. Did we say what the units of epsilon naught were? Farad per meter. Mu naught has the units of henries per meter, okay? Mu naught is henries, epsilon naught farad. So epsilon naught has something to do with capacitance, and mu naught has something to do with inductance. Because mu naught has something to do with currents generating magnetic fields, and that is related to the phenomenon of inductance anyways. That's how inductance showed up in our circuits. And capacitance has to do with charges sitting on two plates and generating electric fields. And that's why when you have only charges and static fields, the relevant constant has farads per unit meter type of, farads per meter type of units. Okay, so displacement is defined, and then it's just the flux of displacement equals the enclosed charge, period. That's the Gauss's law, and this is valid, as I said, also in time-varying situations. And it also helps us sometimes to solve problems in an alternative way to solving problems just using Coulomb's law. All right. So we have now two ways of solving Coulomb's law, static electrostatic problem. One is to make a big summation of Coulomb's law appropriately. Okay. The second one is in situations where that might be cumbersome, but symmetry helps us, use Gauss's law. So we're going to illustrate this with certain examples. And also, this will give us an opportunity to make a distinction what, in the long run, I will call microscopic fields versus macroscopic fields. Okay? So my next example is going to be dealing with that situation. Here we go. This is my next example. I'm almost catching up. I have maybe 10 minutes. So I'm going to now use Coulomb's law to solve a certain static problem. This static problem is as follows. The z-axis is peppered with distinct charges q, okay? There is a q separated from another q, and that separation is delta z. Every delta z, we have a q, okay? And this sort of artificial looking distribution of charges is obviously going to generate an electric field, and I want to calculate this electric field. There are certain symmetries, as you can see, all right? Everything is sort of a uniformly distributed along the z-axis, therefore, on the xy plane, you expect some sort of azimuthal symmetry. It should be the same sort of a field pointing in directions that are normal to the z-axis, irrespective of what angle phi that you have. All right? All that can be easily worked out using a summation that's based on Coulomb's law. Also, I call my delta z to be q over lambda. Okay? Then that lambda dimensionally will have the units of charge per unit length. Okay? Although I have a distinct distribution of distinct charges, okay, if I ask myself what is the sort of average charge per unit length, that is what lambda is. Okay, so that lambda is the average charge per unit length based on this type of the geometry of the charges that are distributed. Okay? So then if I were then to express my delta z in terms of that charge distribution, q over lambda is delta z. Alternatively, average charge is q divided by delta z, because every delta z I have a q. That's the piece, and that's the average charge density. Any questions? Okay, with that introduction, I look at my summation here that is applicable for a position, arbitrary position r, that is placed on the z equals 0 plane, or xy plane. I take an arbitrary location vector, and that vector I write in terms of sines and cosines of phi. Okay? That should look reasonable. Is it looking reasonable? It has a magnitude r, and the cosine phi of that magnitude r points in the x direction. So if I multiply that with unit vector x, that gives me half of that vector. The other half is r times sine phi pointing in y direction, and I combine them. That's my vector r. It's at that vector r location that I'm going to calculate my electric field due to this charge distribution. And then, with that r definition, here is my summation. Charge, I'm now adding each of these terms is one electric field, one Coulomb field coming from one of the charges in question, divided by the distance between that location and the source of the charge. And where are the charges located? The charges are located at 0, delta z, 2 delta z, etc., along the z-axis. So n delta z hat, is giving us the position vector each of those charges. And n is going to go through negative integers all the way to positive integers. That's why my n is running here from minus infinity to infinity. So the observation position vector minus the source position vector, magnitude square, and then my unit vector is the unit vector associated with the very same vector that is pointing from each of the source points to the observation point. Easy enough, right? You following it? Okay, good. All right, some people will daze and say, hey, you know, this is all boring and I'm forgetting about the details. But now, this q can be replaced in terms of lambda times delta z, okay? And I have also combined this in this fashion. Now there's going to be some cancellations. What's going to happen to the z component of the electric field? What's going to happen to the z component of the electric field? Look at it, please, physically. Suppose that my observation point is here, and each of these contributions are giving me a z component. What's going to happen to those z components? They cancel out because they are equal and opposite. Because I set this symmetric, the z component goes away. But what kind of a field do I have? It's only pointing radially perpendicular to the z axis. So that is what I have, and that is exactly after I eliminate the z component and use the lambda. That is the equation that I get that is shown here. And I call that the microscopic field. I have done nothing but very careful superposition of what is given to me, Coulomb's law, that's all. And it's a complicated thing. It's an infinite sum. So it's hard to use. Microscopic fields are difficult to calculate. Oftentimes, we don't need the microscopic fields. Oftentimes, we need a good approximation for that microscopic field. So let's move on. All right. Any questions about the microscopic field? Does it make sense to you guys? Okay. The z component canceled out. The canceled out component, because I don't have a pointer, I have to go jump to the screen, is exactly this component. This component just disappeared. And I replace r by what R is in terms of cosine and sine phi. And then I replace Q by lambda delta z. Lambda stays here, delta z comes here. This is a summation, but it looks almost like an integral. Right? Integrations are nothing other than summations of infinitesimals. Okay? So if we regard this delta z to be very small, and if our location R is large enough, this can be regarded very small. We can turn this summation into an integral and perform the integral. Okay, when I do that, I get a very simple result. You guys can work out the details, okay? I don't want to spend time working out the details, but it is a dz integration. This delta z becomes a dz, and I integrate over z from minus infinity to infinity. You have to look it up, but it's an easy integral to do. What you end up is a radially pointing out vector, okay? A radially pointing out vector, because I recognize my x hat cos phi plus y hat times sine phi as a radially pointing out vector, okay? That's something that you can already see it from the definition of R here, okay? That is a unit vector, and R is the magnitude of the vector. Vector R has a magnitude R, and whatever multiplies it is the unit vector, which I call R hat. So in terms of R hat, I have a field that is obtained after integrating, that is R hat times the charge density, which is Coulombs per meter, average charge density, 2 pi epsilon naught times R. Coulomb's field was Q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught R squared. Now I have another field. It's not a Coulomb field, but it's the field of a uniform charge distribution with a charge density of lambda Coulombs per meter. And it has a slightly different structure. Now we have, instead of Q, lambda, and instead of 4 pi epsilon naught R squared, 2 pi epsilon naught R. And we have a radial unit vector pointing out, but this radial unit vector is pointing out from the line that is infinitely long, okay? It means that it is normal to the z-axis. Slightly different field. But it makes sense. It makes sense dimensionally, because this is in Coulombs per meter. We can afford the R squared having lost one of its exponents. Okay, its dimensional is still correct. Is that making sense? What's your name?
Al.
Al?
Angshun.
Okay, it's so difficult name. Now that we've gone so international, it's so difficult to have all these names figured out. I'm another international, right? So we have all weird names. All right. Did we finish? Okay, no, I haven't finished, because if I finish at this point, I'm losing something. I want to make a point. Please allow me this. Okay? So, this looks like an approximation, but what's really behind that approximation? Let me say that, okay? We can go from this summation into this integral formally by taking every one of my q's and splitting into q over 2, but then changing my delta z's and replacing by delta z over 2. By having my charges on my z-axis, but also by halving the distance between them, I have exactly the same charge distribution. I can repeat this ad infinitum, pulverizing my distinct charges into a continuum charge distribution lambda, and that is what this is exactly referring to. Okay? But this field is not as correct as this field. Okay? Microscopically speaking, I can have, let's go to this picture, and let me just go to this location. Let me just go exactly here. What is the field there?
Zero.
And what is my pulverized electric field equation is giving me? It's giving me, at that point, it's 1 over R dependent. Say, in, phi, ni, t. Zero and infinity, okay? So microscopic field and macroscopic fields are slightly different. They are both useful, but if the fact that the field is zero right here is important, we should use the microscopic field, okay? But if we are never going to get that close to the line and we'll be staying around here, we can get away with the macroscopic field, okay? There are about 10 to the 23 charges in every centimeter cube of stuff, okay? There are many, many charges to sum over, okay? Oftentimes, we don't need to do it microscopically. Macroscopic is what we depend on many times. There are exceptions. All right, so look, let's go. So we'll have to choose our model depending on what we want to do.